We really can't help ourselves when it comes to seeing patterns. I mean, you've seen shapes and clouds and faces and wallpaper, right? A combination of raw brain material and cultural imprinting leads us to perceive patterns, but we also create plenty of patterns. Our guest this hour points out that there are feedback loops. We see patterns and in turn shape the world around us according to those patterns. We have made great leaps in understanding our world. We have also changed it greatly and often in detrimental ways. Jeremy Lent sums all of this up in his book, The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. Jeremy Lent is a writer and the founder and president of the Leology Institute. If the term Leology is new to you, the Institute promotes a worldview that could enable humanity to thrive sustainably on the Earth. Jeremy Lent, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be here.
So is the essence here that we not only see patterns, but in perceiving them, force things to conform to the patterns?
The thing about seeing patterns is that patterns themselves essentially kind of create structures. That in order to make a pattern, we fit things into it, and we kind of ignore the stuff that isn't fitting into it. And that is a great way to understand how we as humans make sense of the world and how we form essentially our sort of cultural worldviews that ultimately drive what we do, what we feel is meaningful, and as a culture, what we do in the world and how we shape history.
Well, the perceiving is universal. I mean, that makes sense. We're all human beings. But is the forcing of the world to fit the perceptions universal, or is that more a European kind of thing in your view?
Oh, yes, I see. I see where you're going on that. And I think it's a human universal instinct to actually create patterns and to fit some things into those patterns and to sort of leave other things out of those patterns. But then what gets really interesting in history is how the different patterns that different cultures actually create are so different from each other. And because it's our instinct, we sort of learn these patterns from the very earliest time, from when we're just basically newborn infants. And, you know, we hear sounds, and nobody tells us to do that, but we sort of begin to pattern the sounds themselves and the touches and feelings we get into language. And we actually form our own patterns of meaning in a way that becomes unconscious. And so actually quite a lot of this book is about is helping us to recognize the patterns of meaning that we kind of live our lives according to without even realizing it, as do other cultures all through history.
Some of the more fascinating parts of the book do deal with language. And when you're just talking now about how we try to make sense of the sounds around us, there's a particularly compelling one where we're bombarded with sounds as babies and begin to try to make sense of them. And that's how language forms ultimately.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, what's so amazing about that is how powerful that can be. There's actually one story I talk about an Aboriginal tribe, actually, in Australia called the Gugu Yimithir, who were really famous for the fact that they actually have their sense of direction, not in the way that most of us think of sort of turn right, turn left, or whatever, but always the cardinal points of north, south, east, and west. So for somebody in that culture, you can kind of twirl them around. They can be in thick fog. You name it. They can be inside or outside, but they'll instantly have this automatic sense of what is north, south, east and west. And it's something that seems like uncanny to us, but it's because from the very first moments of them beginning to learn language, that's the way their particular culture structures how to think about directions. So it's a great example of how at such a deep level, the ways in which we pattern meaning into the world is formed by the language we learn to speak.
Yeah, I love reading about them. I mean, if you're looking for something, no, it's a few inches to your east. And instead of saying a few inches to your right, it's a few inches to your east,
exactly.
That sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just amazing. Exactly. So even if they're sitting in a car, they'll say that. But it's the kind of thing that shows how important that is. But, you know, in a way, though, as I sort of get into the complexity of all this, how language sort of structures how we think, what gets to be maybe even more interesting is something that's a little bit more subtle. It's the fact that at a less kind of deep wiring of our brains, at a more sort of semi-conscious way, we get to sort of find ways in which things are meaningful by the words that our culture attaches to them. And the reason why that in a way it gets to be more interesting, is that, you know, none of us really can ever become a Gugu Yimisir and actually sort of automatically know what is north, south, east, and west, because you have to, like, just grow into that. But all of us really have the capability to look at sort of things that we take for granted in the world, the values we take for granted, and look at what other cultures have developed as different value systems and say, you know, maybe I can shift my own value system. Maybe from my own conscious understanding of the ways in which I make sense of the world, I can change what I see as valuable in the world. And as a culture, we, so importantly, can change what we see as valuable and potentially reshape our future trajectories as a global civilization by doing that.
Which you find very important, clearly, from this book. You write that we're in the midst of one of the great critical transitions of the human journey. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yes, well, when you look at the whole big sweep of history, most people agree that there have been, so far, like two great transitions in the human experience, which really essentially means that really the whole experience of being human, everything from the way in which we relate, the meaning we make from things, what we do every day, changed fundamentally. One of those was when we moved from hunter-gatherers to agriculture, which happened only about 12,000 years ago. Most of human history has been spent as nomadic hunter-gatherers. And that changed pretty much everything. But then another great transformation happened just a few hundred years ago with the scientific revolution in Europe, followed by the industrial revolution, and this kind of modern world that we have right now that has, and that we all know is so different from the past. But virtually everyone who's looked at this agrees that this century, with the amazing rapid pace of change in globalization, in technology, in social structures, and everything else, we're actually undergoing a new transformation.
All right, we'll have to pick that up on the other side of a break with Jeremy Lent. The Patterning Instinct is his book. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, we're talking about the human condition here on the Jefferson Exchange today in a historical and chronological and cognitive sense as well with Jeremy Lent, who is the founder and president of the Leology Institute, which promotes a worldview that could enable humanity to thrive sustainably on the Earth. His book is called The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. We see patterns. We believe that patterns exist, and therefore we continue to create feedback loops in which we enforce our patterns upon the world around us as well. And that differs from culture to culture greatly. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about the great critical transition you see us in now. I mean, we've gone through the scientific revolution, the industrial revolution, and we just talked about globalization. Where do you see this as being a critical turning point for us?
Well, yes, and in fact, the final couple of chapters of my book look closely at this. And in fact, the last chapter is called Trajectories to Our Future. And I think the key thing is that it's not at all clear which direction we're going to transform into. And I see three possibilities, which range vastly. I mean, there's one serious possibility that at the rate in which we're consuming the Earth's resources, we may end up doing what other civilizations have done in the past and collapsing as a civilization before this century is out. And of course, the threat of climate change is only the most obvious sort of existential threat looming on the horizon in that respect. Then there's another potential scenario of what some techno-optimists call like the singularity, or this notion that technology is moving so fast, and along with it and things like genetic enhancement potentially of humans, that there's a scenario where humans themselves evolve into some different kind of species entirely, some kind of neurally interconnected group connecting with each other over the internet. But what I find quite disturbing about this kind of scenario, not just the fact that obviously it leads to such a different sense of what it is to be human, but it might only apply to a small affluent minority of humans, leaving the rest of us essentially in this kind of place of collapse, dealing with all of the environmental sort of breakdown we may be looking at. But there is a third scenario, and that's the one that I think most of us would find most attractive, and yet it's a challenge to get there. And that's a scenario where we actually have a flourishing future, where we find ourselves in more in kind of harmonious relationship with the Earth, where we have greater equality, greater sense of connection between our sort of global community, and where somehow we turn things around and allow the Earth itself not to be consumed at this incredible rate that it is. But in order to get to that scenario, we do need to really change some of the underlying values that our global civilization has taken for granted that drives what we do from one day to the next.
Well, and learning how we create feedback loops between our patterns and the ones that we perceive and those become patterns that we create is helpful to all this. Let's come back to some real basics here. I mean, the prefrontal cortex, or the PFC, as you often abbreviate it in the book. I mean, other animals have it, but are we just have a better, bigger one?
Yes, you know, essentially we have one that is more connected than others. In fact, the other primates, like chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas, also have very large prefrontal cortexes. But we have particular areas of our prefrontal cortex. That's the part of the brain that's at the very sort of tip that evolved most recently. And it's the part that connects with all the other parts of the brain. And so it's really through that prefrontal cortex being so sort of ultra sophisticated in humans that we kind of have this drive to pattern meaning into things. It's really, you can almost think of it as like the patterning cortex. It takes all of the stuff that goes on, these neural connections, billions of connections happening every moment in our brain, and actually begins to say, well, this one happens more frequently in relation to that, so how can I make sense of that? And realizing that what you do actually leads to a certain kind of reaction, and so it begins to affect how you make decisions. And that's what led really to humans looking at the world around us, even at the earliest times, and when we first developed language, and tens or even hundreds of thousands of years ago, and starting to say, there's some kind of pattern in the world. What is it? You know, and begin to try to understand it through trying to impose meaning, essentially, into the universe. And that's really what makes humans unique.
Jeremy Lent is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. It's interesting, though, because you talk about all the great things that we've gained through the growth of the prefrontal cortex and our ability to reason and hold multiple thoughts in our head at the same time. But you also refer to the tragedy of cognition. What is that?
Yes, well, one of the things that happens when you start to get to make sort of put patterns of meaning in around you at the very earliest days is people would see that other people who are just like them die. And, you know, as all mammals are kind of have the instinct, obviously, to not want to die and to do everything to stay alive. But as humans, we got to recognize that, well, we're kind of separate selves. If I see that loved one that I knew, and I see them suddenly no longer moving and dead, well, maybe the same thing will happen to me. So there's this kind of fear of death, this recognition that we actually have separate we kind of have separate existences, and that's only limited in its time, was probably one of the drivers that led us as the earliest humans to try to understand some kind of mythological structure of the universe to sort of deal with this terror. And that's is sometimes called this kind of tragedy of cognition, this terror that arises from that realization of death.
So we have to think that we're not going to just end here. There might be some other place where we go on, where we'll see our loved ones again.
Exactly. And some people see that as actually the primary driver of the kind of instinct for religion and sort of making sense of the universe that we have. But in a sense, I do think it's an important driver, but I think that there's something even more inbuilt in humans to do that. And that's where I really do see this patterning instinct is, even without that fear, we have this absolute need to make a story out of things, to say this is how it all works, and this is how things began, and this is what we're meant to do, and this is what our forefathers and ancestors have done. And all this kind of stuff is really part of what makes us human. But I think that same faculty also allows us to become aware of that. And that's sort of part of what we kind of do in this book a little bit is to look not just at the fact that we make these patterns of meaning, but actually become is kind of what you might call a meta-awareness. How do we make those patterns of meaning? And is there a way that we can consciously shift them by becoming more aware and looking at essentially kind of ways of meaning that other cultures have developed in history?
Yeah, we don't have to think a certain way. It is interesting, though. I did have a bit of a revelation when you got to the idea that natural things were created for a particular purpose. I mean, for example, yes, we make the tools as humans, but we make them out of what nature put here for us. And that begins to get into like, well, who's the benevolent spirit or not who put things here?
Right, exactly. Because we do have this tendency to sort of anthropomorphize, if you will, like see everything as human. And also we have this kind of little bit of this anthropocentric view of things where humans, we love to think that the world, the whole of the universe essentially been created for our benefit. And that was a theme that really got going in Europe in the during the era when Christianity was dominant, in the sense of sort of God created the whole universe for humans, and humans are meant to have this this kind of natural role of dominance over nature. And that actually is one of the sort of fundamental patterns of meaning, if you will, that led to our modern world, the sense that the world is there for humans, ultimately leading to this notion that nature itself is nothing other than a resource for us to use and to exploit in every which way we can for our own human benefit. And that is one of the things I question, and that other cultures in history over the world have not seen things in quite that way.
Jeremy Lent is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about how we perceive patterns as humans, but also in turn how we can shape the world around us to conform to the patterns that we perceive. Feedback loops. Join us on the exchange with your thoughts, your comments, your questions. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You were just talking about different cultures and how the patterns are very different. And in fact, there's a whole section of the book called Patterns Diverge. How did East and West part ways on views of the universe, Jeremy?
Yeah, well, if we look back to many thousands of years ago, and what we find is that across the world, there were big sort of agrarian civilizations that developed all the way from China to Africa, Europe, the Americas. And while they were very different in the way they made sense of things, they did have a shared sense of understanding that there were spirits everywhere in the world, and that humans had to kind of really, there was like a hierarchy of the gods, and humans had to kind of offer rituals to the gods in order to make them happy. And that was a kind of a general shared understanding. And in the West, or at least in ancient Greece, back around 2,500 years ago, there was a very different way of beginning to make sense of the world arose, which was what we oftentimes refer to as dualism, a sense of an actual split universe, where there's a completely two whole different dimensions to the universe. One sort of eternal dimension of the heavens, which is unchanging, and then this kind of more polluted world that we live in and that we kind of live and die in. And there was this sense of the human being also being completely split like that, with a soul that was eternal and a body that died. And the body was really like this, almost like a prison that the soul was stuck in until the body died. And this sense of dualism led to a real extreme sense of separation between humans and the natural world that really we'd never seen before in human history. And I do trace back that new way of thinking as something that led ultimately to our sort of scientific revolution, a different way of looking at nature with all of the benefits and the inherent negative implications that have come from that in the last few hundred years. Whereas in East Asia, you didn't see this kind of split that I just described, this kind of dualistic way of thinking.
That we were basically part of the surroundings, not distinct from them, or there was not two levels of things, it was all one level.
Exactly. And in fact, in traditional China, this amazingly sophisticated sort of worldview developed that saw things as being ultimately integrated. I call it a sense of what was like the harmonic web of life. And if you could imagine like a sort of a gigantic sort of cobweb of the whole of the universe being connected, and you know how just like if a leaf drops and touches a cobweb on a tree, you'll see the whole thing vibrate. So they had the similar kind of idea that anything that any of us does, it leads to vibrations that can have all this kind of impact on everything around in the entire universe. And that understanding leads to a very different way of relating to nature and relating to others in society than if we see as humans as ultimately separate from nature.
Let's take a call in here because I think it relates to this. Carter in Wolf Creek, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jeremy Lent, the author of The Patterning Instinct.
Yeah, a couple comments here. One is, in the Shiva dance of South India, especially, but all over the world also, but especially there, Shiva dances the universe, the world into existence, whereas in the West, we think that we bring into existence by what we're doing right now is talking and listening. And they're two very, very different ways of communicating. And I commend the book to go along with Jeremy's book, the title Communicating by Ruth Finnegan, which lays out all of the different ways that our species communicate with one another. And in the West, affection and dance are particularly suppressed by industrial civilization, whereas in the East, cultural dances, village by village, for example, in Indonesia, are encouraged and cultivated, although when it comes in contact with industrial civilization, it starts to erode, and we suffer from that lack of appropriate communication.
All right. Thanks for that, Carter. So essentially a culture of movement of the body versus a culture that focuses more on the mind.
Yes. And thank you for making that profound distinction. And I think there's so much to unpack there, in fact, that when we look at what is kind of unique, again, about Western culture compared to other cultures in the world, we do find this focus on the importance of reason versus emotion and sort of embodied senses as the sort of way of finding what is meaningful. And if you think of language really as being this product of reason, of our symbolic consciousness, this kind of uniquely human instinct that we've been describing, we see in the West this real focus on language as being this kind of source of truth. In fact, you know, if you go to the Gospel of John in the New Testament, we talk about this notion of logos being like the word, and the word was God, and the word was truth. And it's as though we can only get to the truth through reason. And I think you point out beautifully that other cultures recognize that actually the way that we create the universe, that what the universe is about, is more like this kind of embodied consciousness. So much so, like another example is if you read the first lines of the Tao Te Ching, this amazing text from the traditional China, the sort of ultimate sort of text of Taoism or whatever. It begins by saying, the Tao that can be spoken of is not the true Tao. That, you know, as soon as you try to actually use language to make sense of the universe, you kind of lose some of it because you're doing that patterning we described earlier. You frame it, and by framing it, you leave out some things and you include other things in. So thank you for pointing out that really, really important distinction.
The language issue comes up over and over and over again in the book, and logically so. And there's a great comparison here between ancient Greek and ancient Chinese and just how one is more symbolic than the other, where the Greek is more literal. And, I mean, even the direction in which we look at things, the fact that the Chinese characters do not represent sounds as Western alphabets tend to do, I mean, really makes a difference in how your brain is going to perceive patterns.
Yes, that's right. So even the language itself is kind of more embodied. And the fact that the language itself uses context much more to for somebody to make sense of it than in what are called the Indo-European languages, like ancient Greek or most of the Western languages that we speak. So you do find these deep structural underpinnings that lead to these kind of different worldviews between East Asia and the West. And that's really like one of the core themes of the Patterning Instinct. There are these different ways in which cultures make sense of the universe, but fundamentally this split that happened 25 years ago has been one of the major drivers of history. About 2,500 years ago, has one of the major drivers of history. And so tracing that is a big theme of the book.
Okay, I want to come. We'll talk about the story of Admiral Zheng and his mission from China in the early 15th century in just a few moments. Our guest is Jeremy Lent. His book is The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. We'll come back to the discussion on the Jefferson Exchange and include you in it by phone or email when we return in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are exploring the human mind and how we shape the world around us through the use of that mind. We see patterns. We perceive patterns. Therefore, in the opinion of Jeremy Lent, we also begin to shape the world around us according to those patterns that we perceive in a feedback loop. His book is called The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. And we're going way back to the dawn of language and then to the where East and West sort of split along certain lines of perceiving the world 2,500 years ago. A lot to talk about here. Many centuries worth of stuff. We have a few minutes left. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We just talked about ancient Greece, ancient China, different ways of thinking about the world, and then how it has changed the world in our time, that the Western view became dominant and also became most of the explorers were Westerners. But there's a great story in here about Admiral Zheng, who many people may not know. I'm a little embarrassed I didn't hear the story myself. Walk us through this one, Jeremy.
Sure, absolutely. It does. It's sort of iconic, if you will, of these distinctions we've been talking about. And as you say, a theme we've been going through is how the different ways in which cultures make sense of the world has really shaped history. And this contrast is in the, if we go to the 15th century, it really gives us a sense of what we're really talking about. So we all know, of course, that Christopher Columbus discovered the New World in 1492. But as you mentioned, somebody from that same century, an admiral of a Chinese fleet called Admiral Zheng, virtually unknown in the world. And yet, when he left China with his fleet, a number of decades before Columbus set out, he had this massive fleet. There were 300 boats. Every one of those boats was roughly 10 times the size of one of Columbus's boats. He had something like 27,000 people in this armada. And he essentially, for decades, essentially like owned the Indian Ocean. He went as far as East Africa, Arabia, Sri Lanka, you name it. And wherever he went, he was essentially treated like a god because, I mean, sometimes his whole fleet had more people in it than the cities that he'd visit. And yet, what we see is that it was Columbus with his few dinky little boats and the people who followed him who essentially took over, dominated, conquered, and enslaved these massive continents. And Admiral Zheng, we don't even know. He's sort of lost to the tides of history. And partly of the reason for that is that when Admiral Zheng landed in these places, it never even occurred to him to enslave the populations, to exploit everything, to sort of pillage what was around. So essentially kind of rewrite the rules of how to relate to other people the way that the Europeans did. For him, he took this kind of more traditional Chinese worldview of looking at harmonizing things. And instead of trying to destroy these civilizations, he'd find who was the kind of chief prince. He'd bring them back in his boats to kowtow to the emperor, establish some trading between these different areas, and really kind of establish that China was the center of the world from their point of view, but not with any desire to disrupt and exploit to the max. And that's what we see the those explorers doing in the 15th century. And we can really see the history of the global history from that time onwards to this as one of using technology, using power to exploit and disrupt previously stable situations in a continual pattern. So, you know, to the point that right now, of course, we're dealing with things like exploiting the very balance of the natural world through things like climate change and through whatever, you know, we use up our oil and gas resources. And so we start to move into fracking and tar sands, things like that, to always go to the very end of what we can to exploit what's there. And that, I think, underlies a huge distinction between the kind of worldview that we're on right now and other worldviews that are available.
Well, when you put it in all this context, though, it makes sense that that Columbus et al. Didn't think that they were disrupting a stable situation. All they saw was essentially a pristine wilderness with some things living in it, which were just part of that wilderness and therefore not up to the level of humanity that, that he perceived in himself. They didn't fit his pattern. They didn't fit the explorer's pattern.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, one of the most fascinating things is to look at the journals that Columbus himself wrote when he first landed at what we think is probably Hispaniola, in the Caribbean. And as you say, like, he was just amazed. I mean, the first thing he was amazed by was how naive these people were and how generous they were. You know, they would give anything that the explorers were interested in. They would just give them to them. And they didn't even know what metal was. So they'd give them a sword. They just cut themselves because they didn't even recognize what that was. But what's so fascinating is that he then moves directly, because he's writing this letter back to Ferdinand and Isabel, the emperor, empress of Spain. And he says to them, you know, they're so naive that with 50 armed men, we could enslave them all and take them back and use them for whatever we want back in our back in Spain. So his mind naturally went to this notion of exploitation. And given the fact that he saw his power over the others, he was immediately looking to how can we exploit that to the max. And that was the kind of natural logic and thinking that the traditional Chinese, it just wouldn't have occurred to them to make. And so it just never occurred to Columbus, for example, to say, oh, let's find who the prince is of these Taino, these indigenous people, and bring them back and respect them. And it was like, what can we do to exploit? So I do think that that is where the different worldviews, the different sort of ways in which we make sense of the world leads to natural new ways of thinking about things that one culture has and another culture doesn't.
We have an email here from Tim in Eureka who writes, the brain is wired to think in and expect patterns. That's well established in the book. He says we become attached to the familiar and to our expectations of patterns perceived and or contrived. We can only perceive what we expect. So xenophobia is hardwired, writes Tim. He says this understanding also leads to the possibility of the brain perceiving and or contriving patterns of patterns. This could be our intuition and or subconscious. That's all from Tim in Eureka. Thoughts on that, Jeremy?
Yes, I think that's very, very well said. And I do think that it is an unfortunate truth about the way humans evolved, that because we did evolve in hunter-gatherer communities, and we evolved to have these wonderful qualities of compassion, empathy, caring for our group, but a lot of those instincts are about having compassion for people within our group. So we kind of evolved to recognize people who are in the outer group, like the sort of foreigners, if you will, and see them as being potential rivals. And so I do think that one of the best things we can do to overcome that is to recognize that instinct within ourselves and recognize that because we do have this powerful patterning instinct and we have this ability, and as the person just said, to look at patterns of patterns, that we can consciously reconstruct our patterns of meaning, and we can recognize that some of our inbuilt drives towards something like xenophobia can be overcome through culture. And that's where really it's on all of us to kind of look at our own value system and work together to shift the values of our own culture to move towards ways that can allow for greater harmony and in the world. it's an ongoing challenge. And it's one that, thankfully, if we look at the broad sweep of history, we've done a pretty good job over in the last hundreds, even thousands of years, of overcoming some of those smaller tribal instincts and recognizing it's only been in recent centuries that we even have this notion of sort of global humanity, that all being one shared circle of people together. And so, in fact, I think one of the greatest challenges we have really is to kind of expand that circle of empathy, if you will, to include all humans around us and also the natural world, all other sentient beings that we share the world with.
So we can think in terms of a global humanity, or we can think in terms of tribalism. And that brings us to this email from David and Eugene, who writes, "I'm wondering what Mr. Lent thinks of ideas like primitivism or anarcho-primitivism. I presume he's read thinkers like Marshall Solins, who is quoted in the book, John Zerzan and Derek Jensen. Does Mr. Lent share the views of these authors that the only level of sustainable human society is that of bioregional primitivism? If he disagrees, why does he disagree?" David and Eugene.
Yeah. Yeah, great question. Thank you for asking that. And yes, I am familiar with the work of some of the people you mentioned. Had some really good conversations, in fact, with Derek Jensen. And I do think that there are some great insights in what they say, that we need to recognize that the way in which civilization has evolved does have certain elements about it that are leading to the greater and greater destruction of the natural world. And a lot of times when techno-optimists, if you will, talk about this notion of sustainable development, what they're really talking about is just kind of destroying the natural world at a slightly slower pace than we are right now. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. But I also think there's no such thing as a golden age for us to go back to. And one of the findings of the book is that even our hunter-gatherer ancestors, who clearly, just saw themselves as far more connected with the natural world, they themselves, when they would arrive in new continents like the Americas or Australia, they caused mass extinctions themselves, not consciously, but simply through the power of the human ability to to create weapons and do things that the natural world was unable to respond to. So I think that what we have to do as a human civilization is go forward rather than back. And I think that what that means is learning those insights from hunter-gatherers, from traditional cultures, recognizing that a worldview of us being more interconnected and us being really not separate from nature but part of nature, and that those have to be core elements of the worldview that can lead us to a sustainable flourishing on the earth. But we can also use technology within that. We don't have to reject technology. We don't have to reject our global civilization. But what we do have to do is base it on a foundation of an interconnectedness and recognizing the intrinsic value of all around us, all other humans and the natural world itself, and build on that basis. So we do have some big structural changes ahead if we want to find a flourishing future for humanity.
Our relationship to nature is a huge part of the book and some of the most compelling parts of the book. I mean, when you think about the swing from celebrating the floods of the Nile in ancient Egypt to the concept of a flood as a very bad thing by almost all perceptions in our time. Also thinking about the fact that when we domesticated animals, well, duh, we domesticated ourselves too, because they don't move around anymore, neither do we. And this idea of separation from nature leads us to thinking that we have to control nature. I mean, once we've moved ourselves indoors, it's like when the bugs and the birds and the plants begin creeping up through the foundation and getting into the house, we have to get them out again.
Exactly. So in fact, one way of looking at the kind of sweeps of history in the book is this kind of increase in the sense of separation versus connectedness. And if you will, the ways in which our sort of current underlying worldview that's dominant right now, the sense of humans as conquering nature or seeing nature even as just a machine without any intrinsic value in itself, but just this one incredibly complicated machine that's there for us to manipulate, those are, if you will, some of the ultimate expressions of a sense of separateness from the universe. And I think that values that begin from connectedness are the ones that can lead us to a truly sustainable future. And in fact, Jeff, that is, you mentioned my nonprofit, the Leology Institute. That institute is actually about and the kind of exploration of what a worldview would actually look like that is based on connectedness and integration rather than one based on separateness.
So instead of looking at the end results, you're looking at how we can actually repattern our minds to think about our connectedness with the Earth?
That's right. And in fact, there are many ways in which we can do that, learning, again, from some of the great insights of traditional wisdom, from East Asian wisdom, from Buddhism, Taoism, indigenous cultures, and also learning from some of the most recent findings in science. So this is not at all like an anti-scientific kind of approach, but there's a whole number of branches in modern science called, sometimes known as systems thinking or complexity science. Essentially, they're like the sciences of connectivity that look at recognizing how ecologies connect up, look at how humans interact with each other in networks. And these kinds of sciences offer this a different kind of lens, the same kind of deep insights of interconnectedness that traditional wisdom offers. And that's why I think it's so exciting.
Well, you have a lot of optimism, apparently, about the future of humanity, despite what we've done so far. The book is called The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. It will make you think about the patterns you perceive and why you perceive them. It's the work of Jeremy Lent, who's been our guest in this hour of the Exchange. Jeremy, thanks so much.